being perpetrated on the people of New York. There are 20 million people that could be affected if something goes wrong at this pipeline next Indian Point.
Nancy Venn, I want to thank you for being with us. President of Safe Energy Rights Group, member of Resist AIM, lives in Peekskill, New York. And that does it for the show. Special thanks to Laura Gottesdiener and Juan Carlos Davila for that report. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Chandrina Nadura, Pedro Rodriguez. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of The Lost Boys of Portlandia, a film premiere gala and fundraiser for Outside the Frame, Tuesday, June 7th at 7 p.m. at Revolution Hall in Portland. Outside the Frame is a new organization that empowers homeless and marginalized youth by producing films with youth that convey their life experience. They will premiere The Lost Boys of Portlandia, a riff on Peter Pan, where real lost boys and girls debate if and how to return to mainstream society. They will also screen original film shorts by homeless youth about issues such as drug abuse, gender identity, and the healthcare system. Again, that's The Lost Boys of Portlandia, Tuesday, June 7th at 7 p.m. at Revolution Hall, 1300 Southeast Stark Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing, featuring women's clothing, jewelry, accessories, and gifts with a focus on U.S. made and certified fair trade natural fiber clothing since 1984. Gazelle is located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and at GazelleNaturalFiberClothing.com.
This is KBOO Portland.
Once again, this is Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO FM. And that opening song was a totally new release by a local group called Frogs. An old friend of mine from about 25 years ago showed up in my life once again and dropped this off at KBOO. And I thought I'd play that. Kind of, I joked with her, there was a kind of trying to bring back the spirit of the 60s. Hey, why not? Kindness and trust and truth. Need more of it. That's what we're going to be talking about here today. Talking about truth and reconciliation, a very unique project going on here in Portland. And we'll be talking about that with three guests here this morning, who I will introduce in just a minute after I do the announcements. So coming up Tomorrow, Climate Change and Systems of Oppression, 6:30 to 9 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church. Mm-hmm. Women of color speak out on climate change and system of oppression. They connect capitalism, colonialism, racism, and the prison industrial complex to climate change. They will discuss subjects of war, corporations, banks, slavery, private prisons, property, and white supremacy. Women of Color Speak Out are four Seattle local climate justice activists, Sarah Takola, Afrin Sopariwala, Yin Yu, and Zama Joshi. They were at the forefront of the Shell No protests and have presented at community center, women's prisons, universities, and high schools. So that's tomorrow at First Unitarian Church, 6:30 to 9 p.m. Today at 6 to 8 p.m., Precision Castparts Community Meeting. April 12th, Precision Castparts sent a letter to neighbors around their Johnson Creek facility announcing a public meeting on May 25th, today. And we just learned this meeting will be held at the Monarch Hotel near Clackamas Town Center rather than a central neighborhood venue. And there's members of organizations that have been fighting this air quality issue over for years, and most recently the past couple months, have worked to get the meeting location changed to no avail. So they're asking people to fill the room at 12566 Southeast 93rd Avenue in Clackamas at the Monarch Hotel and Conference Center, 6 to 8 p.m. this evening. Precision Castparts community meeting has to do with air pollution from Precision Castparts. Tomorrow, 5 to 7 p.m., Evict the Landlord Lobby at Southwest Park and Madison. Multifamily Northwest, the well-funded industry and lobby group for Oregon's biggest and smallest landlords, are convening in well-heeled form and fashion to hold their annual ACE Awards. Multifamily Northwest will celebrate and honor their champions who have used no-cause evictions and rent increases to maximum profit. Multifamily Northwest is a faithful donor to dozens of Oregon's elected officials and is proud of their work in opposing any reforms to landlord-tenant law, which might protect tenants and resolve this housing crisis. You can find out more about that. These are all on Facebook if you use that. So that's tomorrow, 5 to 7 p.m., Southwest Park Avenue and Southwest Madison. Join Portland Tenants United for their own award ceremony. They will give notice to Multifamily Northwest that Portland tenants will no longer allow big corporations to dominate the narrative around rent control and just cause eviction reform. So those are coming up this Saturday, Unruly Equality Book Talk by Andy Cornell, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Saturday at Mother Foucault's Bookshop, 523 Southeast Morrison. Andy Cornell talks about his new book on 20th century anarchism called Unruly Equality. Again, these are all on Facebook. Find out more. So with that, and finally, one more thing. Sorry, Verizon Solidarity Picket tomorrow, 3 to 4 p.m., 616 Southwest Broadway here in Portland. Be their fourth week of picketing, chanting, dancing, and leafleting to show their solidarity. Join them every Thursday from 3 to 4 p.m. at the downtown Verizon store to support the 40,000 brave folks on strike at Verizon and Verizon Wireless. Those are all things, and there's probably many more. You can let me know about them here at KBOO. My email address is paulrkboo@gmail.com. And, of course, this evening, the event we're going to be talking about with my three guests, Truth and Reconciliation for People Who Have Experienced Extreme Mental Emotional States, and their families and allies to share their stories encircled by the community. That's this evening from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Center for Intercultural Organizing, 700 North Killingsworth Avenue here in Portland. So my three guests are... first, Cindy Fisher, founder of MOMS, which is Mothers and Others Standing Up Together, and also a founding member of Rethinking Psychiatry. She's the mother of an adult son who she believes was disabled by the label of mental illness and whose actual life experience were discounted by the mental health system. Instead, under the cover of his label, he was given experimental psychiatric drugs that debilitated his ability to think clearly, causing him terrible pain and severe disability. And she started MOMS because as other mothers from around the country began to hear of her advocacy for her son, they called with similar stories of their own disempowerment and abuse by the system that they felt was harming instead of healing their children. So she will be talking about that and this program that they've developed, Truth and Reconciliation. Also, Grace Sylvia, a radical mental health activist and psychotherapist who works with people who want to withdraw from psychiatric drugs. She knows firsthand that, in fact, diagnosed mental illness can be mental, emotional, spiritual, and political healing trying to assert itself. She is involved with Rethinking Psychiatry and also with MOMS, and supports groups like the Icarus Project, the Hearing Voices Movement, and the Spiritual Emergence Network. Also, we have Terry Light, who survived establishment psychiatry's attempts to cure him through forced treatment, which only further traumatized him. Luckily, he found support elsewhere and now works to change the mental health paradigm, especially regarding how the needs of the most marginalized can be met. He is an advocate for human rights and the right to create shelter if none could be found, and works with Right to Survive, Right to Dream 2, and Hazelnut Grove. Welcome, all of you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us, Paul.
You're quite welcome. Well, let's get right into it. We have an hour, which seems like a long time, but time flies. So, Cindy, let's just talk about, for those who may not be staying through the whole program, talk about how this Truth and Reconciliation, what is this Truth and Reconciliation project or program or series of events, and how did it come about?
It's a way to, for me, and there are several of us involved, but it started with me and wanting the silenced voices that I listen to daily, weekly, from mostly mothers of adult children in the mental health system, stories of extreme human rights abuse, constitutional rights abuse, and then the parents who are advocating for their children who actually were experiencing harm in the system, who tried to say, well, can you try a different treatment? Or at some point, things got so bad, it's just let my child out and, you know, I'll figure out some other way of dealing with it. It became like, I felt like the world needed to hear these stories, because the system was so powerful and in some ways so corrupt. And that's not to say that all psychiatrists or mental health practitioners are corrupt, but the system itself was so powerful. When I did the research, I felt like the only person that could make the absolute changes needed was the community. And the community would only come together and unite and make these changes if they heard the stories that have been silenced. So what came to me, I'd been actually praying a lot about how do I get these voices heard, and I came up with the idea of Truth and Reconciliation because of its Truth and Reconciliation is bringing forth the truth of harms that most folks don't know about. So that's how it started, and it shifted quite a bit. In a good way.
Well, of course, people may be most familiar with these large kind of political processes or, coming out of apartheid South Africa, in Guatemala. I heard about a really amazing one in the state of Maine regarding indigenous people, which are in the boarding schools, and which they felt like they were actually one of the most successful in the world. It was really interesting. I got to hear some of them talk about it. So, yeah, this model seems to be getting out there. That obviously that must have been something that you had in mind too.
Oh yes, it was based on the South Africa apartheid reconciliation piece. That's what came to my mind of what they did, and I thought, that's the form I want. I want the community to be there to hear the stories that they have no idea exist.
And so, Grace, how did you come into this, and what? What's sort of been the process? I understand all three of you are on the working group, which includes other people that has been sort of developing the program, and there's already been one back in March. Give us your experiences in this process.
So I want to make it really clear that this is an amazing collaboration between three groups: the MOMS movement, Rethinking Psychiatry, which is an activist educational group trying to shift the mental health paradigm and the paradigm of how care supposed care is offered, and the Icarus Project, which is a support and activist, radical support and activist group in Portland and nationally, maybe even internationally. And that was a really important thing because when Cindy was talking to me about her vision, she realized that she really needed to have the people with the most direct experience, with the lived experience themselves in a leadership role. So she had the idea to try to bring this to Icarus and see if we could collaborate together. And Rethinking Psychiatry, it was a natural because we've been having monthly community events, educational events, and so we already had a platform and somewhat of a gathering. And I'm saying we for all of the groups because I'm part of all of the groups. And it's been an amazing experience. When Cindy was first talking to me about it, she kept saying that her main roadblock was the details, the nuts and bolts, how this would look. Neither of us had the detailed information about how the Truth and Reconciliation process worked. But I had some background in creating group dialogues between people who thought they had nothing in common around hot button political divisive issues like abortion, like lesbian and gay rights. So I brought that model. And that was a model from a group called the Public Conversations Project, Public Dialogue Project in Massachusetts. And I brought it to Oregon back in the 92 struggle. And called it Community Conversations. And so we adapted that loosely and came up with the model of having fishbowls where the one group who had something to speak, in this case it would be the people who've had experience of extreme mental or emotional states, would be invited to come into the center and get to speak with a facilitator to support them with each other, not being interrupted by questions or confrontation or anything. So it would feel like a more safe and inviting space. People could speak or not as they choose. It ends up feeling very supportive, and people are encouraged and kind of blown away by hearing, oh, I'm not the only one. Oh, you've had that too. Then we debrief, and then go to the outer circle, and then people who are families and allies and community with those who've had extreme states can come to the center. And again, nobody's required to talk, but they can and they speak with each other in a supported way. And then debrief, and then everybody joins up again in the full circle, where people can then ask questions of each other. And at this point, people have heard such vulnerability that the questions take on a very different tone than the usual questions, and they're very heartfelt usually, and thoughtful. And then we wrap up with closing comments.
So, if you know, it's kind of the last minute here, but you know, are people who are listening to this able to who can go to this? I mean, who should feel like they might want to participate in this?
Please come, everybody. People who've experienced extreme states, people who have friends, family, partners, allies, community members with people who've experienced extreme states, providers. It would be really great for providers to come and hear firsthand.
And the community at large, because this is something that affects the entire community. We have millions of children that are on psychiatric drugs. We have thousands of people that are in the court system that never have been on drugs, that are court ordered for incompetent, in Washington we call it incompetent to stand trial. And if you get that label, you are forced into drugging, being drugged as a treatment to bring you back to competency. So it affects us all. And I think we need to see the full picture. I would like to say, Paul, very quickly, the reason that I say that it morphed is that Grace helped me to see that it was really important that we recognize and want to hear the voice of, at our last one, it was of the providers. The title was The Receivers and Givers of Psychiatric Service, because there are so many compassionate and caring people that are in that field. And although I have a lot of deep distress about what happens overall, I think it's a systemic institutional oppression that forces folks into those spaces and places where they don't quite feel like this is what they thought they were going to be doing.
And they might begin to lose some of that care and compassion.
Exactly.
Over the years.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
So you've mentioned, Grace, several times extreme mental or emotional states. Is there someone, is it Terry, you want to tackle what, give, you know, if people have never had this experience, I mean, I assume everyone's had maybe something like it. This is a really difficult thing to talk to because we're talking about experience, and experience, you know, we each have our own individual experience. So if someone's talking about something that you've never experienced yourself, it might be, which is why it's so important to listen. But, you know, what does this mean? What are extreme mental or emotional states?
Well, I guess I can jump in on that. I think there's states that you experience that distress you a lot, great deal, and people are not relating to. The part that where other people are not relating to your experience is what creates the disease. And it became really, really helpful to me when I discovered Finland has this process called open dialogue, where people come in and they listen to the person, they listen to family members who've experienced this person's problem, or coworkers or friends, and they all get together and they start building conversation. And they don't have chronic schizophrenia in that portion of Finland because they're building this bridge as a conversation, and then the person's experience is understandable. And that's the part that we don't understand, is how to do this dialogue process. So when I talk about marginalized people, like all these other kinds of problems we're experiencing right now, of reaching across class and race and gender differences, is we cannot do this dialogue piece. We don't know how to do that. It's like, I am I and you are there, and we're at war with each other, or we're in competition with each other. We don't have this process of peace and dialogue in our culture. We don't. And that creates all kinds of disease, because people get traumatized by that. If they don't have enough words to defend themselves, they don't have enough words and language to help understand and communicate back to somebody, I hear you. So those are big pieces that are broken in our culture.
Terry, I wanted to add on that, and you're talking about the Finland process of dealing with schizophrenia. It's in particularly in Lapland, Finland. It's not all of Finland. But right. What's really important to know is that that particular city, if you want, I'm not sure how they refer to it, though, it had the worst rate of schizophrenia in the world. And that was defined by the United Nations. That has very specific symptoms of what you have to have and how long you have to have it. And it's standardized. And we go by that. So they had the worst rate of schizophrenia. And they felt like there must be a better way. So their doctors and psychiatrists began experimenting with different things, and has ended up for the last 25 years of having the best rate of treatment of schizophrenia, where recovery, unlike this country, recovery there is defined as being completely back into your community, you're working with your family, and there's no signs of that relationship break or extreme state anymore. So 80% of their folks that are labeled schizophrenic move beyond that. Here, our disability rates have raised 300% based on the type of treatment that we have. And I would like to say that they emptied their hospitals. their doors are no longer locked. If you go to there, because somebody did a film there, they noticed that there were some patients outside on the grounds, and they thought, aha, I've snuck up, and we found that they still have patients in the hospital. Well, as it turns out, these were patients that under the old rule had been confined for many years there, and now it had became like home, and they didn't have any family. They were older, they were elder, and they didn't want to leave. So out of compassion, they're allowed to stay, but there are no locked doors. There is no forced treatment. This is their home.
Yeah, and then going back to the experience part of that, I've had an extreme state break with reality. And I remember those things because I wrote them down. I remember what happened. I remember all the crazy visions I had. And everything that is on that place where I had this vision in the middle of the city, where I was lost for 4 days, I didn't have a place to go safely because I was lost. But I underwent what happens when you don't get any sleep. And everything that happened in that vision that I couldn't understand then, I understand now. Part of that was, excuse me, I'm sorry. I am sorry. Whoops. But who is the mayor? And I was like, who the heck cares? That was a nonsensical question to me. I didn't answer it appropriately. You know, I know they're just trying to figure out if I was present about this time and this place. And so in reflecting back, it's like that was really useless intervention. And I had enough knowledge of myself that I knew I needed just to get out. And so I found out, you know, my job, it's like, I don't have insurance. Tell them I don't have insurance, and they'll let me out. And they did. And this was for me being savvy about the rights to defend myself. It's like earlier in my time, I had had a sexual assault. And when I went to a women's music festival, and there was a speak out there. There was a woman taken off the land there. And all the survivors came, and they created this big spokes council. And that's the first time I heard about psychiatry. And I was hearing about alternatives to healing. I was also hearing about how traumatizing psychiatry was. And so I had that as like one of my things under my political action belt before my experiencing of psychiatry. And later on, taking care of my nephew, I knew that he needed to figure out how to find his own voice, and he could not do that on the amount of meds that he came up to my doorstep on. So it was my first thing to do, is take him off the meds. And then it started being that he was experiencing voices in his head telling him to do things. And it was after that conversation, the violence stopped. And he was considered severely emotionally disturbed. So this is all a process for me, my knowing that there is a way out of this process, and it's through dialogue, it's through listening.
So it seems like what I hear a commonality is isolation seems to be the kind of a poison that seems to exacerbate all these things. I want to just give out the number, 503-231-8187. If you have any questions or comments, if you know, you yourself have an experience with the so-called mental health system. You know, I was just thinking that, you know, in a way we're kind of replicating the sort of fishbowl model here. We're sort of in the center and out there. Of course, we can't see them like, you know, there are in these truth and reconciliation meetings. But around us, surrounding us is the broader community. So, you know, anybody out there who is not looking at us, but listening in to us, would like to participate in this conversation, please call us up at 503-231-8187. I know, Grace, you wanted to follow up on that.
Yeah, a couple things. One is, when you were asking, so what does extreme states mean? I just want to translate that into dominant culture language for people. Those are states that are often pathologized as depression, bipolar, schizophrenia, extreme anxiety, any of those. And not everybody who experiences voices, for instance, or deep grief and sadness find it disturbing, but often it ends up becoming a disturbing experience, like as Terry explained when it's met with people who don't understand and start telling you you're crazy about it. That's one thing. Another thing, I want to be really clear. Many people, this project came about because many people have had really bad experiences in trying to do their healing with the dominant model, but not everybody has. And so there's room in this process, and we want people from across the spectrum, people who feel like the dominant model has saved their lives, people who feel that the medication has saved their lives, as well as people who see that, yeah, I got some help and some bad things happened, as well as people who felt like this was horrible and I would never do this to anybody. I also want to say two outcomes that happened as a result of the first one that were very profound to me.
And again, the first one was receivers and givers. You actually had people who work in the, quote, mental health system who were there, and you had people who had undergone or received services or been provided care or whatever. So that was, you had both moments of that within the center. We're able to talk.
Exactly. And one was that one of the people who's now, we invited everybody who was there that time to get involved in the planning. And one of the people, a beloved activist in Portland named Kendall, let us know that she actually had been in South Africa during the original Truth and Reconciliation process. And so she has lent a powerful depth to this process of bringing her experiences with the original process to this experience. The other thing is one of the providers ended up getting involved in the planning team. And one of the things that she said is that having participated in that original event has already changed the way she practices. And she gave this powerful story of somebody who came in over the weekend, had a psychotic experience. We call it psychotic, you know, an experience of altered reality, an ability to sense things that other people can't sense, what's pathologized is psychotic, who didn't want to take psychiatric medications. His family didn't want him to take psychiatric medications. And on the way out, he was given the psychiatric medications, and he turned to her and said, "Do I really have to take these?" And in the past, she said she would have given the party line. You know, you really need this for the rest of your life, like a diabetic needs insulin. That's what people are told. And this time, instead, she said, "No, you don't. But you should know that it's a resource if you need it." And gave more information about it and gave the power back to them.
So let me just interrupt. We have a caller. Dennis is on the line. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to report on I was part of the mental health community in Santa Cruz, California, where they have a group. They started a group, I think, about 20 years ago called Mental Health Client Action Network, or MHCAN, which is basically the people, the mental health, the people who are experiencing mental illness in the community have got get together. There's a place where they can get together and talk about their problems, and it's very interesting. You know, they improved themselves just by talking to each other, and they occasionally have a psychiatrist come on the facility and deal with the problems that come up. But mainly, the clients, as they call themselves, the clients themselves who talk to each other. It was a place for them to come and get food, and it, you know, it survived on donations from the community, and it was really very worthwhile. And I would recommend that this sort of thing could be, you know, extended to be done by other communities. That's about all I have to say.
Okay. Well, thank you for calling.
Yeah, thank you, Dennis, for sharing that. And we do have something local a little bit like that. Folk Time is a place where folks who have experienced extreme states go and gather. But I wanted to refer back a moment to something that Terry shared with his experience, which I think is extremely important. These medications are extremely powerful and potent and addictive. And although some folks have been able to go off the medications cold turkey, it can be extremely dangerous, including death, you know, or the symptoms that you thought you were medicating, actually in the addiction, in the withdrawal process, the addiction or the removal of the drug itself can cause all kinds of extreme states that one would say, oh, the illness is coming back, when really it's a withdrawal state. Dr. Breggin, B-R-E-G-G-I-N, has a website and a book, and he's probably the most well-known psychiatrist who says that drugs are not the answer, and he's treated folks in the back halls of what used to be asylums and things like that. But he won't even support people in withdrawing from drugs unless they have a strong community support, because so many things can happen. And with that said, the piece that these drugs are so addictive, I think the most important point that I would like people to walk away with is that it's not so much do the drugs work or do they don't. And the research out there says that 20% of the people are actually helped. And I've talked to people that it's been a lifesaver. But the fact is, if you look deeper into the source of how these drugs came to be, it's based on lies, deceit, power, and control. If you read the book, Robert Whittaker has two books out. He wrote one 5 years ago called Anatomy of an Epidemic. And he's a journalist. And he believed very much in the medical model. And he started delving into why researchers that were trying to create a better way of working with the drugs, and he believed in the drugs, but they were researching about drugs, they would sometimes in the experiment withdraw people from the drugs, and people would have horrendous side effects or direct effects. And so Robert went into this trying to find out how researchers could do such a cruel thing. But as he got deeper down in the rabbit hole, he found out that so much of the research that's given to FDA has been falsified, hidden. People have died in these research experiments that are died on the drugs that are going to be brought forward to the FDA. And the research experimenter would write out that, oh, they lost, so many people dropped out. They didn't say by death or by extreme reaction to the drug. And the media seems to be an arm of this powerful lobbyist force, because they will report the effects of the experiments that are going on, only what the drug companies tell them. So take, for instance, Xanax at 4 weeks was a good panic drug, but at 8 weeks, they had people dropping out, and it was a horrible experiment. Only the FDA and the researchers reported at the four-week mark. So that's what I want to say is
there's a lot of backstories that don't get reported, and as you said, there's some really good resources out there. Dr. Peter Breggin, Robert Whittaker. There's this Mad in America blog. One of the articles you asked me to read, Cindy, Mind the Gap, the Space Between Alternatives and Force. I read yesterday, and it's a powerful, powerful article by Sarah Davidow, D-A-V-I-D-O-W. And of course, there's so many others. There's Rethinking Psychiatry, Icarus, the groups that you all work with, Moms. There's Mind Freedom International. There's lots of excellent groups out there. But I believe we have another caller, Norm. Go ahead, you're on the air. Hello, are you with us?
Yeah, hi.
Go ahead. What do you have to say?
Thanks for taking my call, Paul. I'm a person who, you know, I'm a lay person. I'm not a mental health professional. And I wonder, like, when I'm out and about and I encounter someone who may be, you know, in another space, in a space that's defined as in crisis, what should I do? What shouldn't I do? Should I help? If I should help, what should that look like? I'm puzzled. I'm baffled. I don't know. What would you say?
Let's hear what some of our guests have to say.
One of the things that's really important with people in altered states is self-care for yourself. Because one of the aspects of altered states that I experience is really a heightened sensitivity to other people's emotions.
Uh-huh.
So if you're slightly anxiety, I wouldn't be afraid of you because you are just broadcasting fear. And I would move away from you. Or if you try to get close to me, I would maybe really move away further. So your interior state would be the thing to check and say, how am I feeling? Do I feel friendly? Do I feel safe? Do I feel open? Because that's the state that's helpful in talking with somebody. And a simple hello, you know, if they're engaged in that. And so a lot of times I myself could just continue to walk by and send this idea of a prayer to that person if I didn't feel really up and energized and happy, you know, where I could just kind of play with somebody, because that to me is really useful. Yeah. And so the idea of first do no harm is really important.
And then Terry, what would you recommend if you did feel like you were grounded and centered and could come and address them from a loving place? What would you recommend?
I think coming at somebody in a playful manner where anything goes a little bit. Because there's a really great need for creativity and reaching across to somebody who's not in normal state. You know, I have to have a lot of your creative juices going to help run through the gamut of possibilities, what they possibly mean if they do talk to you. That's part of it, you know, and just saying hello, you know, and how you normally address the people and say hello and just kind of feel like just connect in a meaningful way energetically, not necessarily you understand what they're going to say and stop maybe smiling and that energetic connection is another human being having an experience. I don't know what it is, but I can respect that.
Norm,
that,
did you
want to? That state of being and connecting is another human being. I may be in that space someday, that kind of thing.
All right.
Did you want to follow up on that, Norm?
You know, I have to say, a lot of times, you know, I want to laugh at somebody. Is that appropriate? I don't know. Sometimes people in altered states, to me anyway, you know, I have found them very, very, very much worth listening to and considering, but I don't know if it's appropriate to encourage somebody who might be, you know, talking in a way that I find entertaining.
So Rethinking Psychiatry had a community event back in the fall of a facilitator of a model called ECPR, emotional CPR. There's going to be a training with some of the national trainers in the end of June. And it's exactly for how to work with people, how to connect with people who are going through crises. And I agree with you, Norm, that people have a lot to say that's worthwhile listening to, in my experience. And I love what you're saying, Terry, about approaching it from a really creative, what you're calling playful place. My thing is to connect. That's what the trainer for ECPR talked about. The most important thing is connecting. So if I see somebody's in distress, I might just go up to them and say, wow, it looks hard today, huh? And usually that people like kind of do a double take, like somebody's seeing me as a human being. And then I give them space to talk some, and I let what they say affect me, and maybe tears start coming, and they can see their experience reflected and making an impact on another human being. And that, when I think about when I go through my hardest times, that's the most healing thing for me. So I'd encourage you to look up ECPR, maybe check out that training, and I really appreciate your humanity and compassion around this.
Well, thank you for calling, Norm.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. And the number is 503-231-8187. Let me just repeat who I'm speaking to. The last voice heard was Grace Sylvia, who is a mental health practitioner herself and also part of Rethinking Psychiatry and some of these other groups and movements that are helping put on this event this evening, which I will mention again. You also heard the voice of Terry Light, who works with Right to Survive, Right to Dream 2, and Hazelnut Grove, who had their own experience with establishment psychiatry and extreme states, which brings to bear on their work. Also, Cindy Fisher, the founder of the Moms Group, which is Mothers and Others Standing Up Together. She went through the mill in some way, I guess you could say. I read enough of your article as I could take yesterday. It's a very, you know, as all these stories are, difficult to read, which is, I think, why a lot of people don't necessarily want to go there, because it's, you know, these are really difficult subjects, but you had a really difficult, have had an ongoing difficult saga with your son, which we're not going to be able to get to talk much about today. So these three people are part of a working group that is convening a series of truth and reconciliation events. The first one happened in March, and the second one is happening this evening from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Center for Intercultural Organizing, 700 North Killingsworth Avenue, for people who have experienced extreme mental and emotional states and their families and allies and the broader community.
And you can get that information by checking out rethinkingpsychiatry.org or our Facebook page.
I would also like to say that the ultimate goal is that the community will feel the deepest need for us to come together to create alternative solutions. Because the hospitals and the medication will be there, but if you try to get help outside of that or to get help to withdraw from drugs, the average drug withdrawal place is $10,000 a month. There is no setup for people who perhaps don't need or don't want to take drugs for the rest of their life. There was no place that I could take my son when I started searching, as so many of our mothers do, when our children reach these alternative states and they are perhaps in danger in our community and our society because of the way our society is. There is no other place. And that is part of the control and the power and the greed that those things don't get funded. But the hospitals will get $1,000 a day or more to force drug and treat our children. That's got to change, community. We get to create more compassionate, caring, non-force alternatives filled with love and compassion.
Before I go to our next caller, I wanted to say you talk about in responding to Norm and talking about to making a connection and relating to the person. But, the problem is there's, sometimes when these things happen, a break from so-called reality, whatever that is, but the reality that as defined by, the systems that we live in, happens. Sometimes there's a break from family, a break from friends. Mm-hmm. And so people kind of, get lost in a sense, and they don't no longer have those. Again, there's the isolation, no longer have those connections. It's kind of this vicious spiral that happens. And then, if people get involved in the system where they're, maybe forced to do things, coerced, and then they react to that, it sets up another dynamic. So anyway, my feeling is, it's a lot of people hesitate, rightfully so, to interact with people because it's kind of a commitment. You know, it's like you establish that. Well, then where do you go? It's like what the person really needs are good ongoing relationships. And if you're, you know, if you're not ready to provide that anyway, I just want to sort of throw that out there. But we have another caller, I believe. I think it's Kyle, perhaps. Go ahead. Yeah, you're on.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It was an interesting conversation. I have an experience myself. I've been trying to stop smoking, and, you know, my doctor, I asked her what I could take, and I asked her about Chantix, and she said, read the sign on the box, and you probably don't want to take that. And then she says, well, you know, there's another one that's it's a little milder that I think it would work better, maybe, would be Wellbutrin. I said, okay, you know, fine. So I got set up with it, but, you know, I haven't taken any yet, and, you know, I've been cutting back on the cigarettes and stuff, and it's, you know, of course, that causes its own anxiety, but because there's underlying anxiety that the nicotine covers up. But anyway, you know, I'm kind of, you know, every time I mention this to one of my friends or in support, they go, oh, God, Wellbutrin, you don't want to take that. It's like, you know, it's got me to the point where I'm, you know, hell with it. I don't know if I really want to take this stuff or not, you know, but, and then I go, I was thinking, you know, well, gosh, once I get on this stuff, what's it going to be? That am I going to have to go through the same thing, you know, when I get off the Wellbutrin? I mean, you know, so maybe I'm just prolonging the withdrawal effects, you know, so I'm not sure where to go with it.
Well, let's hear what some of our guests have to say about that. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
I think I'm probably the only person in this group who's ever smoked, so I'll answer that. One of the things that's really great for anxiety is smoking. And the answer to that is real community and real friends and feeling secure in who you are and other people know you. And one of my best exercises that helps out with that are chi exercises, where I'm actually breathing and moving the chi in my body, because that's one of the things that tobacco does really well. It moves all the chi in your body. And it opens the chi, and it grounded me. But now it's like having friends was the really important thing for me. The last time I smoked is because I was hitchhiking and having to make friends really fast, and like talking to people I don't know really caused lots of anxiety for me. So smoking was my antidote. And then if you get to do Wellbutrin, it's like one of the side effects of Wellbutrin, if you try and get off, it can be seizures. I don't know if any kind of thing like that with tobacco. So that's what my answer is around that.
Okay, so we have another caller. Tim, before we go to Tim, so what can people expect? You know, we mentioned several times, we're really not into, there's so many directions to go in that we barely touch the surface on. But so there's this Truth and Reconciliation event this evening, from 6 to 9 at the Center for Intercultural Organizing. What can people expect there?
Community, a lot of community and a lot of heartfelt truth telling. We want people from across the spectrum of experiences to come and talk about what their experiences were like, and in particular with a focus about how, if I was a person, and I am a person who's, this is Grace, I've had my own extreme state experience, and that has informed my work as a therapist and why I became a therapist. And so I'll be talking, for instance, about how my experience was dealt with by my family, how it was supported or not supported, and both positives and negatives we want to hear. We'll also have families and not just families, but community, allies, partners, be talking about their experiences, not what the person who they were supporting went through, because that's their story to tell. But what it impacts everybody directly, and we want to hear your experience. So in the ways that I've supported people who've had extreme state experiences, what was it like for me? What were the challenges? What were things I wish I had done differently? Which were things that I found were really, really seemed to be helpful and really helped me? And also Cindy's piece that she is fiercely, relentlessly brilliantly bringing forward is how families who are trying to advocate for change and how the person they love is being treated by the system, their experiences, because they get pathologized and validated and targeted. And so all there's many complex dimensions and perspectives, and we would love all of them, including people who feel like they had good experiences. That's a really important piece to get the fullness of the experience, and we all benefit from more truth.
Yeah, I just want to flag this article about Cindy's story, which I linked to in the program page for this program, which you can find on our website, kboo.fm. Just look under today's schedule and you'll find this program, or just look under Wednesday Talk Radio. It's called From Compliance to Activism, A Mother's Journey. And again, it's a really beautiful, very powerful piece, very disturbing piece. Just I sense at every turn, the frustration that you dealt with, had to deal with on an ongoing basis, and that so many other people, whether you're personally caught up in it or someone you love or know is caught up in it. And again, it's so difficult. It's almost like, you know, you see someone slipping away and then they got like grabbed by this entity or system, and it's like, ha.
Yeah.
And I've, you know, talked to people who've experienced that. I just want to say, you know, I participated actually myself in that first one, because I actually had my own experience, which I kind of like always sort of to minimize in a sense, because I felt like I kind of escaped by the skin of my teeth, you know? And actually, I was actually kind of, quote, saved by one of these extremely powerful drugs, you know, which I was able to take and sort of schedule myself and wean myself off of, because, you know, I had the presence of mind, but I felt like I was just so close to losing that control completely. And it's like, it scares me thinking about it to this day, you know. It's like, I have no idea what could have happened, you know? And that's what, it's hard for people to understand, you know, that's why we take drugs to keep that control, to be able to continue to function in society, because, you know, if you go over the edge, you know, it's a whole other world out there. Anyway, what's that? Jay, sorry, I was talking to, no one could hear that, to Liam. Let's just go to a real quick caller and see if we can meet that question quickly and then wrap this program up. Jay, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I am interested in what's going on or is projected to help people who are aging to develop community. When you're aging, after a certain point, community kind of disintegrates. People that you're close to die, or they're disabled, and their people just aren't able to move around as much. People can't hear as well, this kind of thing. What is going on specifically for aging, say, 70 and over?
Well, that might be a totally separate program. I don't think we can really get into it in the 3 minutes we have left. I know there's the Village program, which is working on that. Go ahead, Terry.
I think what you're talking about is like, how do we address the systemic marginalization of people who don't fit in to the working of our system? Because I feel like one of the fundamental things we have is a capitalist system where it's profit over people, profit over the planet, and we've lost connection with reality in a big way. And
right.
Part of that reality is our experiences of our elders. And
exactly.
So
I would
brought say- here about community and village, the way we used to live before capitalism came along and started concentrating wealth, and then going and conquering other cultures and destroying those wisdom traditions around grief, around what happens to our ancestors. We have lost a lot. We are at this place where we don't have a lot.
So,
okay, and Cindy wants to say something.
So just, Jay, come tonight, because the whole thing is that the community has to rebuild itself. We have to recreate the village. So the answers are us, within us.
So we only have a minute left here, and I know there's a number of resources in Portland to plug into, in addition to just coming this evening and to Center for Intercultural Organizing, 700 North Killingsworth, from 6 to 9 p.m. for this Truth and Reconciliation. But there's also the Icarus Project, Portland Hearing Voices, North Star Clubhouse, and Folk Time, among others. And I will link to all those on the program page and rethinkingpsychiatry.org. So we are flush out of time here. As happens, it always goes so fast. But thank you so much to Grace, Cindy, and Terry for being with us this morning.
Can this be downloaded? Will this be recorded?
Yes, this will be available.
Okay.
Perhaps we'll have there's talk of maybe getting a podcast going for this. At least I've been talking about that. So maybe we should think about that. We might be ready for that step. But we are out of time. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you so much.
Okay, and this is Wednesday Talk Radio. My name is Paul Rowland. Stay tuned for Political Perspectives.
Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Here's what we have coming up for you this morning on KBOO. First, it's Political Perspectives, today featuring a lecture by Dale Resinella about his experiences as a death row chaplain in Florida for 18 years and his expertise on what the Bible says about the death penalty. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. At 10:15, Flashpoints features excerpts from Requiem for the American Dream, the new moving film about Noam Chomsky, based on 4 years of interviews. And at 11 on the Recovery Zone, host Stephanie Potter interviews Perry Gruber, founder of the group Copiosis, a resource-based economic system about retiring capitalism and repairing our world.